So, we were looking at Daniel chapter 2 last week. We're going to look at Daniel chapter 3 this week. And for anyone who knows about Daniel, this is one of the two stories that you know. Everyone knows the lions, and everyone knows Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they're obviously both fantastic stories. This is, I mean, these are the ones people remember for good reason. It might be interesting to see what they would say their reason is, why they like it so much. I have a tendency to believe that in both those cases, it's that, in this case, that they're saved from the fire, or in Daniel's case, that he's saved from the lions. And that is great, but as we'll see today, that's not actually the center of the story. It is a great outcome, but it's not actually the most important part of the story. Just as in last week's reading, it's interesting too that many of these chapters, the most important part often gets overlooked or kind of bypassed really quickly on the way to get to the end. So last week we had this dream. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he wanted his experts to interpret the dream, and they couldn't interpret the dream because he wouldn't tell them the dream beforehand. And they said, "Well, yeah, just tell us the dream." And I mean, as we talked about this a little bit in the first chapter too, about these Chaldeans, these Babylonians, these Magi. One of the things that they study is astrology and interpretations of dreams and this kind of thing. And so they tell the king, "Listen, you tell us the dream. We'll line those up with our dream manuals, our dream deciphering books, decoding books, and we'll tell you what it means." And Nebuchadnezzar said, No. This is how it's going to work this time. If you're so great, if you're such an expert, you tell me the dream and then you interpret the dream." And they say, "Well, no one can do that." And they were right in that sense that no man can do that. But right there in the center, when Daniel goes to the king and then asks for time, the center and the hinge is where Daniel prays to God and then gives praise to God, because God is not a man. He can interpret dreams. He does know everything. He is omniscient. And if he wants to, he can tell Daniel the dream and then tell Daniel the interpretation. That prayer and praise that Daniel gives to God is actually the center feature of the story. And as we said last week, then Daniel goes to Nebuchadnezzar and tells him the dream. And you find out that the dream is not really about Nebuchadnezzar at all. The dream is about the latter days. The dream is about the Messiah. The dream is about the Christ and his kingdom coming and breaking that fourth kingdom, or the feet of iron and clay, I think it was, and then becoming a kingdom that captures the whole world and becomes a great kingdom that lasts forever. But the kind of the hinge of that entire story was Daniel's prayer and praise of God. Similar to this week, the center will not actually be them being rescued from the fire. That is great, and obviously it points forward to the greater salvation that will be at the end of time. But the hinge is much earlier in the story, and sometimes what we go right by when we're reading the story. So again, Daniel's always dealing with experts, of which he is one, and his claim is not that experts don't know anything, but on the things that they know and on the things that they're supposedly so certain on, many times they don't even know that as well as they think they should. So last time it was with the dreams and the interpretation of dreams. Oddly enough, modern psychology is set up on a similar, at least this is one of the pillars of modern psychology, is Freud and Jung, huge into interpreting dreams. Now modern psychology has kind of moved past that in some sense, but there's still, even today, like Jordan Peterson, who's been famous lately, he's a Jung scholar. If you look up Jordan Peterson's first book, which I don't recommend, I haven't read, I've read about it, but a lot of it is about interpreting his bizarre dreams. And we'd like to think, well, who these days would go by that? Who would see that as an authority? Well, like I said, modern psychology is set up on, at least that's one of the pillars. And it's a shaky pillar, one would think, at the least. This time he's going to go at the experts a little bit different way. And always, at least with Daniel, the experts are wrong in their supposed knowledge of how the world works, and most keenly, who the true God is. And we talked about in the way back when we began the book that it began with Daniel and the other Judeans getting an education in 3 years of education in Babylon. But as one of the commenters pointed out, and I think I quoted this a couple weeks ago, the first three chapters are, or first four chapters actually, are about the education of King Nebuchadnezzar. And you see that as he, in chapter two, he was thankful to Daniel for giving him the interpretation of the dream. And Daniel made clear to point out, hey, I'm a man just like your other experts, but God, the true God, can give interpretations to dreams. And he is the one who is revealing this to you. And Nebuchadnezzar had given some kind of thanks to the true God for this. In chapter 3, we're going to see Nebuchadnezzar, though, obviously didn't become a believer in the sense that we think of it. He's willing to acknowledge the God of the Judeans as another God. He's fine going that far. But even at the end of chapter 3, it's not like he's going to fall down and worship the true God as the only God. And chapter 4 will end up a little bit more closer to that when more things happen to Nebuchadnezzar and he comes to realize more and more. But chapter 3, as always, if anyone has questions, feel free to unmute yourself if you're on mute. Unmute yourself, jump right in, or you can... there's a way to text or comment here at some point. You can certainly do that, and I'll read them that way. But other than that, let's get into chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So this is the first chunk of the story. This one's a little bit different in that it doesn't say exactly when this happens. The earlier one and some of the later ones, it tells you in what year of the king that this happened. Doing just some good footwork, the scholars have estimated a date of late December 594 or January 593 as a possible date for this golden statue. Now, why is this? How did they arrive at something that exact? Well, it is clear that King Nebuchadnezzar this is clearly going to be an act of and a confession of loyalty, not only to Nebuchadnezzar's gods or the idol that he sets up, but to King Nebuchadnezzar himself. And it may play off of chapter 2 and the dream. If you remember, the dream that Daniel interpreted for King Nebuchadnezzar was a statue of four different metals, or I guess different kinds of metals mixed with other stuff, but the head was gold. And he said that was King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, or the reign of the Babylonians, and it was the golden part. And maybe a bit prideful of that, or maybe taking that as a sign, Nebuchadnezzar then sets up a huge idol of gold. That this is why he does it this way. But the other thing is, he's bringing all the officials of the provinces in for this. That this is an act of loyalty, that he wants to know that all the leaders, all the different governors, satraps, prefects, counselors, treasurers, justices, magistrates, all the officials, that they all are on board with this. And he will know immediately if they're not. And he can burn them and set up another governor. And so there's, by looking at a couple of other places in the Bible, namely Jeremiah and then 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, they find that the Babylonians set up kings. And they demand fealty from these rulers in these various provinces of Babylon, and that he actually does this. He brings them all in for this kind of thing. So this is how they can get it, perhaps 594, 593. I think they said that the Greek translation puts up something like in the 18th year of King Nebuchadnezzar or something along these lines. And there are a couple different things running through this passage. One is the seriousness with which Nebuchadnezzar is taking this. He wants everyone to bow down. And as we said, he sees that as not just a recognition of Nebuchadnezzar's gods, but a recognition of his authority as king. And it's one of the commenters pointed out, it just happens to be a thing with rulers, especially if they become autocrats or dictators or tyrants. They almost always end up dabbling in religion. They can't help it. They need to move beyond just the status of servant of the people or leader of the people. They tend to want to make themselves bigger than that and claim more authority than they can. And we'll see how that plays out later on in the reading. But we know it's true even of presidents today. They all have to dabble in religion. And up to this point, it's always been at least paying lip service to Christianity, in the States at least, at least lip service to Christianity. But you see that their real religion, at least in the States, is what they call secularism, which they would say is not a religion, but which we would push back and say, yes, it absolutely is. It's making religious claims. It's absolutely claiming that no religion is better than another. No religion can tell you how the government, the state, the country should be run. And that is a religious claim. And so all rulers dabble in religion. And we can't buy into their lie that no, this is outside religion, this is secular. No, that's not true. How a country is ruled, how its people are to act, what kind of laws you set up have claims on what people do, on what people say, on what people think. There's no way around that. We talked about a few different weeks ago, I think it was, I was preaching it, but the sermon dealt with questions of what is good. Well, in a way, a country and a government is set up around those very things. They're set up around things that the government declares, this is what we want people to do. These are things that we don't want people to do. And so there are always religious claims when you are setting yourself up as an authority, a leader, a ruler. And Nebuchadnezzar, as a king doing this, is no different than any other ruler. Now, he is a little more dictatorial and tyrannical in that he says, you have to do this now, or I will burn you in a fire, which no president as of yet has claimed or acted like he wants to do. But you can see the seriousness with which Nebuchadnezzar takes this act and this service. One of the things that's kind of beautiful with how Daniel has written this up is he's th there is this way of obeying dictators and rulers according to just doing every little thing that the law requires, just doing every little detail. And eventually, I mean, usually in those kind of stories, the ruler just gets fed up and says, no, just act normally, right? You can't all stand exactly when I walk in the room or when I get up, or I mean, th there just has to be some lax in the rules, because everyone following the rules, if they're extensive enough to the letter, ends up with nothing getting done. But this isn't exactly what Daniel is doing, but what Daniel's doing is writing it in this style. And so you'll see that over and over throughout this chapter, there's repetitions, and Daniel doesn't contract any of these things. So every time he is going to write it up, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, the officials. Likewise, when he gets to when he gets to the musical instruments, hornpipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music. You would think normally when we write that up or speak that the first time, and then we condense it to the satraps, etc., or et al. Dot dot dot, some kind of ellipses to cover those things. But Daniel chooses not to do it that way when he writes it down. And so that whether you're reading it to yourself or if someone's reading it to you out loud, like when we do it to the service, in the service, people immediately just get fed up with this, and they see it as, kind of, why do you need to repeat this? This is a little bit cartoonish. And yes, it is. This is exactly the way Daniel has written. But what I was saying about the way that Daniel writes this chapter is that he makes fun of, he pokes fun at the pomp and the seriousness of King Nebuchadnezzar and the supposedly serious affair that is going on. He pokes fun at it just in the way that he writes it up. And as one commentator says, he turns it from pomp into pomposity. And that, as I said, anytime you hear this or read this, you just kind of get fed up with the foolishness of all that is going on. Although it is a serious story in that people's lives are on the line. If they disobey, then Nebuchadnezzar is going to throw them into the fire. And this is one of the things that is interesting about this chapter too, is the pressure that is put on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And notice that Daniel does not write their Jewish names here. He uses their pagan names. They are regarded as pagans, just like everyone else in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And they are supposed to act like pagans, like all the other people in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And so Daniel just leaves their Babylonian pagan names in there as one of the ways of pointing out what kind of pressure these Judeans are under. And obviously, this thing is written down not just for them. Obviously, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego already went through it, but it's written down for all of the people of God to learn from them and to see that it can be like this. And so the pressure that comes to them is just a few different kinds of pressure. One of them is, of course, just the pressure from the king. The pressure is from authority. The king, someone who is over them, a lawful authority over them, tells them to do something. There's that kind of pressure. Second, you also have the pressure of just peer pressure and conformity. All of the peoples, nations, and languages fall down when the music sounds. That they look around, everyone else is doing the same thing or doing what the king wants of them. But there's also the pressure of the hatred that they will feel in their own hearts, that they know when they don't do this, people are going to hate them and people are going to not like them. And so inside themselves, there has to be this pressure that we all feel whenever the rest of the crowd is doing something else. And Daniel layers this on rather thick. The king's told them all the peoples are doing it. They themselves know what will happen to them. I mean, they're under a penalty if they don't do this, and that they do not, or I guess as we will see, spoiler alert, as we will see, they actually won't go along with this. But we can go on from there. Verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Okay, so we'll pause there before we get on to the actual furnace. But here we go. We have, this isn't quite a setup in the same way that Daniel chapter 6 is a setup, but the Chaldeans and the other magi and wise men are just as envious and jealous of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and later on Daniel, as, I mean, this is clearly one of the things that motivates them. Earlier on, they were, of course, forced to become vegetarians by Daniel for those 3 years of training. But in chapter 2, they were showed up by Daniel because Daniel consulted the true God and was able to do something that they were not. And then Daniel gets exalted, just as at the end of chapter 1, I think Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael, get exalted to very high positions. And the other Chaldeans are jealous of this, and they obviously want these positions for themselves. And there may be a little bit of jealousy too by the fact that these guys are Jews, and they, in many cases, they themselves are probably Babylonians, and they can't believe that foreigners would get the kind of exalted positions that these Jews do. Whatever the reason, I mean, this is just true in politics in general, but I mean, we recognize this is always true, and even in something like office politics, we always want the higher positions, and hopefully we don't go to these kind of efforts and means to arrive at them, but in politics they quite often do. This is exactly why King Nebuchadnezzar might have been leery of them in chapter 2, when we talked about them maybe not wanting to interpret his dream the right way. This may have been the very reason that Nebuchadnezzar was leery of the Chaldeans in chapter 2, was because if he told them the dream and they saw an opportunity to promote themselves over him as king, I mean, he's very right to be a little bit paranoid. Kings in the olden days weren't wrong to be paranoid. Very often, people were after their thrones, were after their power. And Nebuchadnezzar is just like them in that way. Another thing going on at this point, so they tell him, hey, these Jews do not fall down and worship your God. And they see this obviously, and the king does too, as a slight of the king himself, not just the king's God. Nebuchadnezzar's religiosity, who knows how religious to his gods he was. But the king clearly sees this as an act of loyalty to him. And when it's pointed out that the Jews will not bow down to his God, he sees this as disobedience to him. And so Nebuchadnezzar flies into a rage. He commands that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought before him. Obviously, he knows them in some way. And so you see that he doesn't immediately just toss them into the furnace, but he gives them another chance. Right? I've heard, is it true that you guys don't do this? I don't know if that's true or not. He doesn't even let them answer the question. He just says, we're going to have a do-over. Now we're going to play the music all over again. Then you can fall down. If you fall down, well and good. We just move on as if nothing happened. Clearly, I got a bad report. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? So this is the other way that Nebuchadnezzar exalts himself. He places himself above the gods, right? What God could possibly deliver you out of my hands? If I'm going to throw you in a furnace, what God is greater than what I am about to do to you? It seems like an odd punishment, and obviously a large furnace. But this is not the only place. In Jeremiah chapter 29, he talks about this being used as a form of punishment as well. He talks about it. So Jeremiah 29, verse 22, because of them, this curse shall be used by all the exiles from Judah to Babylon. The Lord make you like Zedekiah and Ahab, whom the king of Babylon roasted in the fire. So there are other places that this is marked out as an actual punishment. It could be either a special fire specifically made for this kind of thing, which, yikes, or it could be something like a brick kiln, something that would be huge and large enough that it would be done and it would also be able to withstand very, very high heat. And this might be the kind of fire that he would be using. But you see then that Nebuchadnezzar gives them chance number two, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, no, don't play for us the hornpipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every other kind of music. We don't even need to go that far. And then verse 17, if this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. That is an interpretation. It's not the exact translation, and you'll understand why. Let me find you. So the actual words say, if our God whom we serve exists, he is able to save us. Now, many of the translators and interpreters don't like the straightforward translation because it seems to say, if our God whom we serve exists, it could be taken as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego think God might exist, and if he exists, he could save them, or that he might not exist. But that's clearly not the case. All over the story, there's no hint that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego or Daniel ever doubt the existence of the true God. If you just take the translation straight across, if our God whom we serve exists, he is able to save us, you could just as easily interpret as, listen, if the true God exists, and they clearly believe he does, then he's able to save us, right? So there, when the ESV, and the ESV isn't the only one, many of the translations do this, when they say, if this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, they just want to emphasize not that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego doubt the existence of the true God, but they just want to put the if on, if he wants to, he can save us, which is a fine and pious thought. It's not an exact translation. I just wanted to point that out to you, that the straight-up translation is, if our God whom we serve exists, he is able to save us. But as we said, even if you, when you use the straight-across translation, it's getting at the same thing, namely this. They're not doubting that God exists, and they're not doubting that he can save them, but they are leaving room for the fact that God does not need to save them from this. God is not bound to save every believer who steps into a fire. That's just not what he's bound to. Just as, I mean, the church praises many of the martyrs in the early Christian era exactly because they did go to their death confessing the true God. And the fact that they were eaten by lions and burned or chopped in pieces doesn't mean that they were less believers than Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And this is why I point, this actually is the hinge of the story. This is the main point of chapter 3. The main point of chapter 3 is not that they are saved. The main point of chapter 3 is that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were obedient to the true God here when they refuse to bow down, and when they tell the king, we are not going to bow down and serve your gods. We believe in the true God. He is able to deliver us if he wants to, and even if he doesn't, but if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. That right there, verses 16 to 18, is the centerpiece of this chapter. And it is what Daniel is writing it down for the rest of the church and the rest of the believers after him to see as the example, that we are called to obedience to the true God first and foremost, and he is higher than all other earthly authorities, and that the first commandment is a non-negotiable. We saw in chapter 1 that there are some areas where the church is able to negotiate, and so when Daniel and his and the other Judeans have this qualm about eating what the king has laid out for them, then they do negotiate. They don't say, okay, we're just never going to eat. They say, hey, can we eat this instead of this? And the guy does a trial run with them, and he says, yeah, you look fine. In fact, everyone's going to eat like you eat. You look better than the other guys. And so there was room for negotiation there. Here, there is not. Here, it's straightforward idolatry. Here, it's straightforwardly bowing down to an idol. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, no, we're not going to do that. There's no negotiating with it. We and this is the same thing that the early Christians had to come up against as well when they were told to burn a pinch of incense to Caesar. Right? So Caesar was seen in some way as a god or demigod, a son of the gods, the savior of the empire. And so they were told, all people were told to burn incense to Caesar. And Caesar was like, it doesn't have to be much. It could be a pinch. Just throw in a pinch of incense. That'll do you. But the church saw this as a way of going against the first commandment. No, we're not going to give you a pinch of incense. Just as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not going to bow down. Even if it's one quick bow, they're not going to do it. Because that is worshiping, acknowledging another God, and giving him loyalty and fealty and obedience along with the true God. And they just say, you know, you don't need to play all those instruments. We'll just tell you up front, we're not going to bow down, right? And this is, as I said, the hinge of the chapter. And you see that Nebuchadnezzar is filled with fury. This is something that even though he's a ruler of the mightiest empire of the world at that time, he cannot force them. His power has limits, and it makes him furious. So he's filled with fury. The expression of his face was changing in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. So picking up in verse 20. And he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted him, and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies, rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So here's the follow-through. Nebuchadnezzar is filled with fury. He orders the furnace heated hotter, 7 times hotter. He orders them bound and cast into the fiery furnace. So they are. They have all their clothes on them. They are bound with some kind of rope or some kind of chain or something, and they're thrown into the fiery furnace. And it's so overheated that the flame kills those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Right? Just getting at the... He is a tyrant. He is a dictator. He doesn't actually care for other people as much as he cares for himself. And just in a rage, even if others are killed, it doesn't matter. The fact that his power has met limits just sends him off the rails. He cannot stand it. And so he has them cast into the burning fiery furnace. And then it switches gears and this just goes to King Nebuchadnezzar's point of view. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Didn't we cast 3 men into the fire?" They say, "Yep." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men, and they're unbound, they're not tied up, they're walking around in the midst of the fire, they aren't hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." So here we have, obviously, and as I said, even though it's not the center part, it's not the hinge of the chapter, it is still very cool, and we're right to remember this part of the story. It is fantastic, and it puts the words in this unfaithful king's mouth to tell us what is actually happening. First of all, the 3 men are alive, they're unbound, they're unhurt, and someone has joined them. And the fourth, he says, is like, his appearance is like a son of the gods. So what does this mean? Who is the fourth person? Son of the gods is sometimes used as it's a way of talking about angels. But the other thing that we automatically go to is, could it be Christ? I would say, yeah, absolutely. We see Christ pop up specifically as the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. And one of the ways we specifically see him come out that way is Exodus 3, the burning bush. He appears in a bush that is in on fire and yet is not consumed. And here again we have someone who appears like a son of the gods, which also means, I assume, he's glowing, right? He's blindingly glowing. And he appears with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and yet they are not consumed with fire either. That this is what's going on here. And it's interesting that there, to us at least, it's interesting that nothing else is said about him other than Nebuchadnezzar saying this. I mean, the fourth man doesn't walk out of the fire with them. And Daniel gives us no other explanation of the fourth man either. It just happens. He's with them, the believers in this, and he keeps them safe. And then he leaves the story as they come out of the fire and come and talk to the king because the king calls him out. But nothing else is said about this guy, which I think immediately holds our fascination even more. We want to constantly know more about this guy, but nothing more is given at this time. I think he is probably Christ walking around with them, or he is another angel that God has sent, just as he sends an angel in Daniel chapter 6 to stop the lion's mouth. But this isn't even what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had predicted, or even probably what they were expecting. When they talked to the king earlier about, you know what, if the God we believe in exists, he could save us, I don't think that they had this in mind. I don't think that they had that a son of the gods would show up and walk and be with them in the fire. I doubt they had that in their mind at all. Maybe they did. But it's clearly not what Nebuchadnezzar had in mind. But this is where he comes to them. He comes to them not before, not after. He comes to them while they're in the fire, right? And so one of the commenters, this is just a beautiful passage from one of the commenters, Christ did not keep them out of the furnace, but found them in it. He does not always shield you from all distresses and dangers, but it is in the loneliness, in the betrayal, in the loss, that the fourth man comes and walks with you. He has the knack of both exposing you to, yet keeping you through, waters and rivers and fire. The fourth man can always find his people. The fourth man can always find his people. But this is just, I mean, obviously we point forward to the Gospels. This is just kind of one thing that's at the heart of the Gospels, is that Christ joins in our suffering with us. And this is one of the deepest parts about it, is he does not avoid it. He comes into it himself, and he meets us there, so that no matter what happens to us in life, whatever griefs, struggles, trials, temptations, all of those things, he has been through them, and he joins us in them. That this is at the heart of the gospel itself, and that we are not left alone. And we see earlier, so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, hey, our God can save us if we want. But we also, if you think about Christ in the gospel, and especially the Garden of Gethsemane, Christ prays that prayer himself, right? If this cup can be taken, then take it. Nevertheless, thy will be done. And we know, of course, at that point, the Father will not take the cup from him, but will let the Son of God himself undergo all of that suffering, grief, betrayal, and trial on our behalf. And that always in the Old Testament, the punches are pulled. This is just another way that it's pulled. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego pray this way. God's will be done, and God saves them. They're not burned. Their hair isn't even singed. They don't even smell like smoke, it says. No smell of fire had come upon them. They don't even smell. It didn't affect them at all, other than it was an experience that they went through. But it didn't harm them in any way, shape, or form. Whereas the punch will not be pulled on Calvary. there Christ, the Son of God, will actually undergo these things for us. And it won't be pulled from him. He will walk through the fire and be consumed in that manner of speaking there on Calvary. Obviously this is the beauty of this story, is the faith and the obedience and the confession of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Clearly Daniel's using them as an example for us in whatever day, age, time, temptation we may come through. But also as a type of Jesus Christ himself that points forward to Christ's own temptation, trial, suffering, death, but then resurrection. And this is the thing that the martyrs believe too, is if the God we believe in exists, then he can raise us from the dead, right? That's not what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego pray, but it is what they believe, and it is what the church believes these days too about the martyrs of all times and places. Even if the Nebuchadnezzars of the world get a hold of us and put us to death, our God can raise us from the dead, because there is an authority higher than the Nebuchadnezzars of this world. There are kings, there are authorities, there's a King of Kings, there's a Lord of Lords, and he can nullify what Nebuchadnezzar can do, just as he nullified what Pontius Pilate was able to have done on Good Friday. And so we see they come out to Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." Now, he doesn't confess that this is his God. He confesses that the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is clearly a true God. He sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. And so he commends them for a couple different things. One, for their faith, right? They were saved by their faith. Nebuchadnezzar says this, though he delivered his servants who trusted in him. They believed in the true God. And in so doing, they set aside the king's command. And by the king, he means they set aside my own command, and you yielded up your bodies rather than serve and worship any god except your own God. And so Nebuchadnezzar commands them for their faith in the true God, for setting aside his own command and yielding up their bodies rather than worship any god except their own gods. And then he makes a decree. Therefore, I make it a decree. Any people, language, nation that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. So as we said, at the end of chapter 3, even here, Nebuchadnezzar is not going to make his own confession and repentance that the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is the true and only God. But he is going to acknowledge him as a god in the pantheon. He's amazed that he's able to rescue these guys in this way. But he makes this decree that just shows that he, as much as he advances, he just hasn't quite learned that much yet, because he makes another decree that he just cannot enforce, right? If you speak anything against this God, then I'm going to tear you limb from limb and your house will be laid in ruins. This is just... it's different than the decree he made at the beginning of the chapter, but again, it's just a decree that where he sees himself set up as above the gods. Okay, I'm going to protect the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego now, right? If anyone says anything against him, they have me to deal with. And so Nebuchadnezzar is still being educated. We will learn more about his education next week in chapter 4. And we will pick up there, and hopefully, sorry about that, hopefully the Zoom will work properly. Experts and technology are never wrong, as we always know. So next week, obviously, everything will be right and true and proper. But before that, let us close with prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for bringing us here to read your word, and especially about the faithful actions of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we ask that you would strengthen our faith, that whenever we come upon temptations and pressures, as much as they faced, or even the lighter ones that we face in our time, we ask you would strengthen our faith, that we would confess you in the same way as the true God, the God who can save, and that we would go into the future, knowing that you do save us. You may not save us if we're tossed in a fire, but we know that you have saved us from sin, death, and the power of hell and Satan, and that you will raise us on the last day, because this is what you have promised through your Son, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.